from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, today the leader of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, also known as FARC, gave the order to stop firing, ending a 52-year war between the Colombian government and the guerrilla group. The war claimed more than 220,000 lives and displaced at least 5 million people before a ceasefire was reached in June. Under the agreement, which some critics denounce as too lenient, FARC members would serve no prison time if they confess to their crimes, and the treaty must be ratified by a public vote on October 2nd. We'll discuss it next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Wednesday, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos announced a deal signed in Havana to end hostilities with the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The negotiations, which began in November 2012, will presumably put an end to the over half-century armed conflict. A public plebiscite ratifies the agreement and a nationwide referendum slated for October 2nd to make the accord official. Over the course of the conflict, over 220,000 lives have been lost and over 5 million driven from their homes. In this opening hour, we want to discuss the terms of the agreement in this opening hour, as well as what lies ahead. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We want to welcome from Washington, D.C., Cynthia Arntzen. She's director of the Latin American program with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and she has written and edited numerous works about Central America and the U.S. role there, including In the Wake of War, Democratization, and Internal Armed Conflict. And Cynthia Arntzen, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we also want to welcome Daniel Restrepo, who is senior fellow with the Center for American Progress. He's also with us this morning from Washington, D.C. And from 2009 to 2012, he was special assistant to President Obama and senior director for Western Hemisphere Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome, Daniel Restrepo.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. And we are going to talk with David Tolbert, who is president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. We'll get him on the line with us as well. But let me go first to you, Cynthia Arntzen, if I may. And let's begin just by talking about the deal itself and what it represents. I mean, it was officially announced today that the accord is on. And there's a lot in here about land reform, about overhaul of anti-narcotic strategy by the state and by the state expanding into neglected areas, especially rural areas. But I suppose what's pretty much raised the hackles and caused the most controversy is the so-called restorative or transitional justice, which we will indeed talk about in the course of this hour and get into in some detail. Let me go to you, though, about the narco trafficking. How is narco trafficking suddenly going to end? Because they're talking really about turning over not only weapons for monitors from the United Nations to check, but actually stopping narco trafficking.
Well, first let me say that I don't think that it's reasonable to expect that narco trafficking is going to end with this peace accord.
Forgive me, end by the FARC, I should say.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Exactly. Even an end by the FARC. There is one of the five agreements that is part of this peace accord that was signed but approved and announced by the government and the FARC last week. There is a provision on illegal economies, including narco-trafficking, and it commits the FARC to doing a number of things. Most important of that of those are the helping the government with manual eradication in the zones of influence that it has had. And then second, and I think this is really critical, is turning over to the government information about drug trafficking routes and corridors and the more sort of business aspect of the drug trade. I think there is some expectation that some of those things will happen, but there's also good reason to believe that some mid-level commanders probably of the FARC who have been deeply involved in the drug trade are simply not going to accept the terms of this deal and will continue to traffic drugs not as the FARC but in collusion either with the remaining armed group, the ELN, or with the so-called criminal bands known by the acronym BACRIM, one of many organizations of organized crime in Colombia. So this is not by any means an end to narco trafficking. It's an end of certain FARC involvement in the drug trade and possibly also illegal mining, but it is not definitively the end of FARC involvement in drugs. At least that's the expectation.
Or for that matter, just the ongoing attempt to stay in the drug business, which is huge in its profits. And you've got dissidents in the southeast jungles refusing to lay down their arms and probably refusing to stop doing anything about narco trafficking. Now I'm talking about the first front. I wanted, though, to talk about this idea of laying down arms and actually integrating the FARC into the political process, making a political party out of them. How is that going to be achieved in this agreement?
Well, there is a provision for the concentration of FARC troops. It will take place in coming weeks. The Colombian Army will guarantee the safe passage of guerrillas into these pre-designated 23 zones. In Havana, which is where the negotiations took place, there were members of the Colombian military that worked with FARC military commanders and other negotiators to come up with this particular procedure. Now, I think it's worth mentioning that Colombia as a government has decades of experience in demobilizing guerrilla and paramilitary groups. There are something like 25,000 members of various guerrilla groups that have demobilized either in collective or in individual capacity, many of these people obviously having deserted. There's another 30-plus thousand former paramilitary commanders. And the Colombian Reintegration Agency, the ACR, is an enormously impressive and enormously experienced organization in Colombia. It provides years of assistance and training and follow-up. And the people that have successfully completed this program, the overwhelming majority of them do not go back to armed violence.
Cynthia Arntzen, again, is director of the Latin American Program with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and she is with us by phone from the nation's capital. So is Daniel Restrepo, who is senior fellow with the Center for American Progress and who served as assistant to President Obama and senior director for the Western Hemisphere Affairs at the NSC, the National Security Council. And Daniel Restrepo, let's talk about the American role in this. I mean, certainly there was a lot of concern about U.S. Being blamed for interference in the war, you could call it, because that's what it was. It was going between the FARC and the Colombian government, especially with respect to the drug cartel. The United States is pretty much out of this picture. You know, Plan Colombia was very much seen as a central involvement of U.S. Influence in Colombia.
So Plan Colombia is an important piece of the background here, quite frankly. The Colombian state and the support that the United States gave to the Colombian state and the massive investment Colombia made on its own behalf. And that's, I think, an important lesson to keep in mind in terms of turning around the security situation in Colombia from what it was at the beginning of this century and in the early 2000s, when a lot of people talked about Colombia as being on the precipice of being a failed state, to now being on the precipice of this historic peace agreement. The security capacity of the Colombian state and the ability of the Colombian state to exercise force, if you will, in all of Colombian territory for the first time in the history of Colombia is part of why we are here, part of why the FARC came to the table 4 years ago at the beginning of these negotiations. In a lot of ways, they had been militarily defeated. But as in any counterinsurgency, you don't end up killing the last insurgent. The purpose is to bring them into politics. And you mentioned this earlier. Part of these agreements is an entry point into political life so that the FARC and folks who share their beliefs can pursue their agenda through the means of political expression rather than violence and terrorism, as they have for a long time. So the United States played an important role in helping the Colombian security state get back on its feet to create the conditions where a negotiation was possible. The United States played a supportive role in negotiations themselves. A couple years back now, a special envoy to the negotiations was named by President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry. Bernie Aronson, who's had a long history of in the Americas, a storied diplomatic history in the Americas, was an important figure a crucial figure in the Central American peace processes of the 1990s, and played an important role in helping facilitate this long, arduous, and highly detailed negotiation that has taken place over the course of the last 4 years.
It is indeed arduous and detailed. For a long time, the FARC was saying, you've got oligarchs ruling Colombia, and they're under U.S. control.
Yeah, and that was part of the mythology, if you will, of the FARC. And the FARC has been an interesting organization in the sense that it began as a Marxist uprising in the 1960s and has had a number of kind of iterations. And as we were just talking, certainly at an operational level, parts of the FARC have been deeply embedded in the narcotics business now for some time. Begging the question of how much ideology was still there. And Colombia has had its challenges, obviously. It's the inequality. It's among the most unequal countries in Latin America, which is the most unequal region of the world. So there are concentrations of landholding. It's one of the most concentrated landholding countries in the world in terms of the smallest number of people holding the most amount of land. So there have been legitimate challenges to kind of socioeconomic justice in Colombia. Colombia has made an enormous amount of progress in addition over the course of the last 15 years to the security progress that it has made. It has also made significant inroads in reducing poverty, reducing rural poverty, but it's got work left to do. And again, the accords, not just the substance of the accords, but the end of the internal armed conflict opens the door, and it's a real challenge and a real challenge, opportunity and challenge for the Colombian state. As I mentioned earlier, for the first time over the course of the last 10, 15 years, the Colombian security state has managed to project itself to all corners of Colombia. Now comes the hard part, which is projecting the entire state, the provision of basic services, which is something that the central government in Colombia has never been able to do in the history of the country, to reach all points of the Colombian territory with basic services. And now that's part of what has to happen now for this or any other agreement to take hold and to get at the sources of inequality that have plagued Colombia for as long as they have.
Well, as many devils as there are in the details of this accord, which, by the way, in terms of its text, we really haven't seen yet, although President Santos says this is definitive and this is the final and presumably it's going to move forward. I'm just wondering, though, a couple of things, Daniel Restrepo, I'd like to hear from you. What about the role of Cuba and what about the role of Norway? They were pretty much the two sponsors and integral partners in this whole accord.
Absolutely. Played a fundamental role in the diplomacy behind this. The fact that the talks took place in Havana was important. It allowed to create an environment in which these very delicate negotiations could be carried out. Ironically, kind of away from the prying eyes of the media in many ways, certainly for the first couple of years. And I don't think that was an accident. But also ideologically, the back when the FARC got going, and the FARC General Secretariat, the leadership, still presents itself in kind of Leninist Marxist terms. And have a strong affinity for Fidel Castro more than Raúl. But so the Cubans played an important role, and the Norwegians have played a fundamental role in the diplomacy because, again, these were not easy talks. There were many times that they could have and partially went off the rails. And the work of Norway and Cuba was fundamental in keeping the parties at the table and moving forward in a positive direction to get to these agreements. The agreements have been very hard to get to. Fundamentally, they're the easy part. Implementing them is going to be very challenging, and getting at these core issues that we were talking about a moment ago is really where success or failure is going to lie.
Then the government has promised protection for essentially many who have been involved in some fairly serious, one could even describe them as capital crimes, assassins and so forth, and narco-terrorists. At the same time, the tens of thousands of people have disappeared and there's still captives that are unaccounted for. I want to bring David Tolbert into this. He is president of the International Center for Transitional Justice, and he joins us from the Caribbean this morning. And David Tolbert, good to have you aboard. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Sorry to be a couple of minutes late. We got a trouble with the connection, but I'm here now.
Well, we got a good connection, and we'll hold it forward. I want to talk to you about transitional justice and restorative justice, because that's a whole part of this agreement, and maybe in some ways the most controversial. The concern over amnesty and what transitional justice is going to mean, especially to human rights groups and victims and so forth. Mm-hmm. Let's have you spell it out for us. What does the accord call for?
Yeah, I think it's important to lay it out in a little bit of detail, because I think there are a lot of misunderstandings both about what international law has says about serious crimes, and there are a whole variety of experiences. And one of the things that we do at the International Center for Transitional Justice is provide expertise on a whole range of approaches to deal with the past, to deal with serious crimes, to deal with these abuses, to help restore civic trust in the authorities. So truth commissions play a really important role. There have been some 40 truth commissions around the world. Obviously, criminal prosecutions are important, but this is a, you know, I'll come back to that in a moment.
Well, let me just go to truth commissions. Is there going to be a truth commission set up?
Yes, there is. There's a truth commission at the heart of the process. So a great deal of international experience has been drawn upon for that. And so there's a truth commission. There have been extensive reparations programs. I think some of your earlier speakers have mentioned that. So the victims have been at the center of the process. There are a number of reforms that have been talked about earlier. But when we come to the issue of a criminal prosecution and who's going to be held accountable, the Colombian the negotiations have done some things that I think are worth talking a little bit about. First of all, with respect to amnesties, I'd point out first that international law does allow for amnesties as long as they don't touch on war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. And if we look at Protocol 2 of the Geneva Conventions, which deals with internal armed conflicts, actually liberal amnesties are actually encouraged by international law. The more fundamental question, though, is for these serious crimes, in this case, potentially war crimes and potentially crimes against humanity, how are they being treated? And this is where the agreement provides for the special jurisdiction for peace. And it provides an arrangement whereby there's a confessional system whereby those who've committed crimes can either go through ordinary justice if they do not come forward and provide a confession, or into the special jurisdiction for peace if they do. And if they do, then the penalties are not the usual kind of imprisonment, but some confinement and within specific areas, providing the truth and some other steps, which is, I think, the controversial part of the deal.
Well, you mentioned all the international examples. Is there any model here? I mean, I know, for example, you've talked about and written about expectations, and Kenya went too wide and Tunisia went too wide. On the other hand, mm-hmm. You have examples like Chile, South Africa, Argentina, which seemed to be restorative in the real sense of the word and really brought some amity and brought some even, I suppose, what you could call restorative justice. So is there a paradigm here that's operating for?
I think it draws on a number of experiences, but I think it's a unique approach, and this is one of the reasons that it's caused so much discussion. We certainly have had specialized chambers in a number of countries, both national and international. There are a number of international experiences, you have mixed chambers of international judges and national judges. And, of course, I think that that experience is being drawn on for these for the special jurisdiction for peace. What I think we probably haven't seen is a situation where someone comes forward and confesses, and then obviously in many jurisdictions one receives a reduced penalty, but in this case there's the question of what the penalty will be, because the agreement talks about being confined in specific areas, but it pretty clearly does not talk about jail time.
No, but I've been reading about no prison or reduced prison for guerrillas who confess or are honest. That was what Juan Santos called the most difficult toad to swallow. I'm using his language now. I want to actually follow up on this in another way, if I could. David Tolbert, again, is president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. Let me go back to Cynthia Aronson for a moment, just so people can understand what's happening here in terms of tracking this. There's going to be a plebiscite, a vote of the people, a referendum on this, Cynthia Aronson, on October the 2nd, and we've already seen a good deal of opposition, particularly to the idea of transitional justice, the fear that people won't be punished for their crimes. And we've also got former President Uribe, Alvaro Uribe, essentially campaigning against the accord. So how do we size up what's likely to happen on October 2nd?
Well, it's very difficult. I personally believe that the vote in favor of the peace accords will win, but both the government and the opposition are geared up significantly. And I think it's important to recognize that the campaign against the peace agreements has been going on almost since the negotiations began and certainly became public. Alvaro Uribe, the former president, whose actions in the military sphere with Santos as defense minister certainly paved the way, I think, as Dan Restrepo mentioned, for the success of the peace talks, has been bitterly opposed to the negotiations, believing that the FARC should only be considered narco-terrorists and that they, in fact, are on the verge of defeat. And I think that is a mistaken notion. The FARC has about 6,000 or 7,000 fighters that can continue to wreak havoc in the countryside and sabotage oil pipelines in areas
that
where
music
most
is telling
of the
us. I'm sorry that we're coming up on a break, and I do want to get our listeners involved in this. There are going to be 5 seats in Congress for the FARC, by the way, if this accord is approved. But as Cynthia Aronson just pointed out, there is a good deal of dissent and a good deal of argument against it. It's supposed to actually bring land reform and rural development and all kinds of things, but will it pass the plebiscite? I'd like to hear from listeners. I know many of you would like to weigh in here, and many of you have questions or comments. Colombia reaching a deal to end the 52-year war with the FARC guerrilla group. If you'd like to join us, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This focus, our opening hour of Forum, is on Colombia. Today, the leader of the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, gave the order to stop firing, and this ends a 52-year war between the Colombian government and the guerrilla group FARC. The war, by the way, claimed more than 220,000 lives and displaced at least 5 million people before a ceasefire was reached in June. And under the agreement, which is complicated, we're trying to flesh it all out here, a number of critics have denounced as too lenient. FARC members would serve no prison time if they confess to their crimes. And the treaty has to be ratified by a public vote on the 2nd of October. We're talking about this with Cynthia Aronson, director of the Latin American Program for the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, with Daniel Restrepo, who is senior fellow with the Center for American Progress, and with David Tolbert, president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. And we do want to hear from you, and we want to hear your thoughts about this. Any questions you might have, certainly like to hear from people who know Colombia or have lived there. And I think one of the basic questions about this accord is, if it does go through, if the plebiscite passes and there is a successful referendum and there is a great deal of conflict and tension over that, what's it going to mean? It's certainly not going to mean, as we heard earlier from Cynthia Aronson, an end to narco-terrorism, and it's not going to be the end of the drug trade, which is in the billions of dollars, and other groups certainly wanting in and, you know, wanting essentially part of that action. But it does perhaps bring to a conclusion, at least a kind of tentative conclusion, potentially, and Santos, the president of Colombia, wants this to be his legacy, a war which has taken an extraordinary number of lives and caused a great deal of carnage. We do want to hear your thoughts, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Are you positive, negative? How do you feel about this agreement, especially those of you who have been following the events in Colombia these 52 years, or some of those 52 years, because that's how long this war has been going on? You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also join us by tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I want to get a caller on here, and that's Patty. And Patty, join us. Welcome.
Hello?
Yes, Patty, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, how much would this peace accord with the FARC have to do with the potential legalization of marijuana in California and possibly the rest of the United States? Because I have heard that the president of Colombia wishes to get into an international legal marijuana trade with the U.S., and would Colombia become basically a marijuana banana republic?
Well, Patty, it's interesting you should bring that up, because in our next hour we're going to talk about the business side of Prop 64 on the November ballot here in California, which would legalize marijuana. Some speculation maybe, Daniel Restrepo, from you on how this would affect marijuana here, especially since we've got legalization not only in California but Colorado, Washington, happening throughout the country.
Right. We have 25 of 50 states who have legalized or decriminalized some form of marijuana over the course of the last few years in the United States. And Juan Manuel Santos, the president of Colombia, has certainly been amongst the most vocal elected leaders in the Western Hemisphere, saying we need to rethink global drug policy and its effects, and kind of and treat this much more as a public health concern than necessarily a law enforcement issue. So I think that that certainly is part of Santos's thinking, and as we discussed, one of the tenets of this agreement is to create greater cooperation between the Colombian state and these folks who have been engaged in the business, both to do the kinds of local rural development that you need to create alternatives, livelihoods for folks, but that there are Colombians looking at getting into the legal drug business, into the legal marijuana business, is something, quite frankly, that was covered in the New York Times in the last couple of weeks. So it is a factor. I would not by any means describe it as the motivating factor. The motivating factor here is to bring to an end a conflict that, as you've discussed, has claimed the lives of more than 200,000 Colombians and has affected the lives of millions and millions of Colombians over the course of the last 5 decades.
Let me thank Patty for her call and go right to another caller, and that's Reggie. Reggie, welcome. You're on the air. I'm sorry. Did you want to say
thank
something,
you.
Alex? David Tolbert?
This is David.
Forgive me.
Yeah, if you don't mind. I just wanted to emphasize this point that Daniel's just made. It's a 52-year conflict, hundreds of thousands of victims. And this process really put victims at the heart of the discussions. Victims were brought to Havana. Their views were heard. There were broad consultations with victims in Colombia. The product of this long negotiation does very much address a broader range of justice issues, including ensuring that reparations. We also talked about reintegration earlier. There is a truth commission. The special jurisdiction of peace is an innovation in a number of ways, but it solves or helps resolve a conflict that's been going over for 50 years. So we see human rights and justice playing a really important role in ending this conflict. And yes, there are some difficult compromises, but I do think we should celebrate, in a sense, that the fact that the longest-running conflict in this hemisphere and one of the longest ones in the world is being resolved with an emphasis on victims, on human rights, and ultimately on accountability. I thought that should be underlined.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you did. And again, David Tolbert is with us from the Caribbean and president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. And we were talking before with David Tolbert about the role of the United States in this. Reggie has a question along those lines. Reggie, go ahead.
Yes, I'm just curious about what our role has been in the negotiations. I know we've been active in the war on drugs, which has funded a lot of the a conflict, at least on the FARC side, from what I've read, and what our role will be in the final negotiations, and the enforcement of the agreement.
Yeah, go ahead if you would, David Tolbert.
Sorry, I missed a little bit of that question.
Well, the question was what the U.S. role was in the settlement. You alluded to some of that.
Oh, sorry, yeah. I think Daniel's maybe in a better position to talk about that, but I think the U.S. was obviously put its oar in the water and was helpful. I think the key the as was alluded to earlier, Norway played quite a key role in assisting the parties and co-sponsoring this. The Cubans obviously played a role. Ultimately, a lot of courage on the part of the government of President Santos and others. And the U.S. played a supporting role, and I think that's appropriate.
Daniel Restrepo, want to add on here?
Yeah, I had the privilege of being present when President Santos told President Obama that these talks were taking place, first in private, in secret, when I was still working for President Obama, when we visited Colombia in April of 2012. And from that moment, and certainly as the talks became public later that year, the President Obama and the entire administration have been very supportive of President Santos and his effort to find a peaceful resolution to this conflict. And you also see a pivoting, and there was an event at the White House earlier this year, both celebrating the last 15 years of cooperation between the United States and Colombia, but also thinking about what does the relationship look like going forward, something that we've written on here at Center for American Progress, and the announcement of something called Peace Colombia or Paz Colombia, as a successor, if you will, to Plan Colombia, and geared much more towards how can the United States financially and with particular expertise go about supporting the implementation of these agreements and the kinds of reforms and the kinds of changes that still need to be made in Colombia to build a durable and lasting just peace. For example, a significant U.S. investment along with some Scandinavian countries in demining. Colombia has one of the biggest mine problems in the world in terms both from the government and from the FARC's use of mines, anti-personnel mines over the course of this conflict. And now the hard work has to start of demining much of the Colombian countryside to make the rural parts of Colombia able to be more productive. That's a small example of the kinds of cooperation that the president has proposed. It's supporting Colombia moving forward. It's a proposal in his budget that's currently sitting before the United States Congress for roughly $450 million of annual assistance under this banner of Peace Colombia or Paz Colombia as the successor to Plan Colombia.
Daniel Restrepo, since you seem rather positive in many ways and hopeful about this agreement, I wonder what you would say in response to a listener who writes, this is Alex, who says, these agreements amount to nothing less than negotiating with terrorists. The message sent is that you can be cowardly kidnappers and murderers, and if you kidnap and murder effectively enough or long enough, eventually you can reach an agreement under which you'll be forgiven.
I think that misses the point of what's going on here. And this is not just a policy issue for me. My last name is as Colombian as it can possibly be. I have a lot of family still in Colombia. My older siblings were born in Colombia. I have dozens of cousins who live in Colombia. So this is a conversation that I've had, and some of them support this agreement, and some of them don't support this agreement. But it's part of a political conversation in Colombia, and that in and of itself is a welcome sign. But for too many times in Colombia's history, political differences have been expressed themselves in political violence. And this is an opportunity for Colombia to put the era of political violence behind it and to express itself going forward through an active and vibrant democracy.
And again, Daniel Restrepo, a senior fellow with the Center for American Progress, and from 2009 to 2012 was special assistant to President Obama and senior director for Western Hemisphere Affairs at the National Security Council. I do want to go to more of your calls, but let me go first to Cynthia Arnson, who is director of the Latin American program of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and she has written and edited numerous works about Central America and the U.S. role there, including In the Wake of War, Democratization and Internal Armed Conflict. And one of our listeners wants to know what the role of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela was in supporting the FARC. Cynthia Arnson?
Well, initially in the peace talks, when this was just begun in secret between the Colombian government and the FARC, Hugo Chavez was still alive and, by all reports, played a very positive role in convincing the FARC that it was time to negotiate with the government and was, the time for armed struggle was over. And the fact that someone like Chavez had come to power through an election was one of the arguments that was put forward to the FARC as a reason, you know, why the era of armed struggle in Latin America was over. There have been any number of reports about Venezuelan military people lending territory, lending support to the FARC. I tend to think that some of that happened, but I also tend to think that it was less significant than many have said. When President Santos first came to power in 2010, he made it one of his first foreign policy initiatives to make peace, essentially, with Colombia's neighbors, with Venezuela, with Ecuador, because the FARC, during the military campaigns earlier in that decade, had pushed the guerrillas to border areas. And so getting the cooperation of neighboring governments in the campaigns against the FARC and helping to seal those borders was a very important security and foreign policy objective of the Santos administration. And I think there was some partial success in having that happen.
You mentioned the election that Chavez commented on. This plebiscite is going to take place with not only a great deal of tension and polarization, as has been commented on, but the possibility of low voter turnout. That's been often a pattern in Colombian elections, unfortunately. Here's Elena, who writes, regarding peace without retaliation, those heard in the past may not be pleased, but those who will not be heard in the future will be grateful. Let me go to more of your calls, and we go to Andre, who lived in Colombia. Andre, welcome.
Yeah, hi. I've lived in Colombia for many years, grew up there, moved here, been living in the States for about 20 years, and I'm planning on going back. I got to tell you, this is one of the most polarizing issues that I've ever come across between friends and family. Everybody's very passionate about this. You got the Uribistas, which have followed Uribe, you know, almost like a cult. And then you got the people that want peace, you know. I think a big majority of Colombians want peace. It's not a perfect accord, but it's a good step in the right direction. We've been having wars for more than 50 years in Colombia. This all started with a Bogotazo, and it's continued from then on, you know, and like I said, very polarizing. I think we need to stop the madness and legalize drugs because that's what's funding all the narco-terrorism. Thank you very much.
All right, Andre, thank you for that call. We'll let your comments stand, and we'll get another caller on here, and that's JJ. JJ, welcome.
Hello.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Oh, I called in to remark that this, to me, as a person who's functioning as a missionary, fighting the drug addiction that exists down in Colombia, this is more President Uribe's legacy than it is President Santos, because President Uribe, he's the one that has started the conversation in de-escalating the war. So if he's against the present accords, I would agree with him.
Okay. Again, I thank you for that editorial comment. Appreciate hearing from you. And we'll go to Gloria next, who is Colombian. Gloria, welcome. Where do you stand?
Okay. I'm Colombian. I have been living in the United States for the last 20 years. The history of my country has changed, and it will be changed forever. Colombia is a very complex country. It's not only geographically, cultural, but politically. My comment is that I would like in the future, if you're going to make this program, invite somebody from Colombia. And also, I'm very sad about the legalization of marijuana because I think it's a hypocrisy. Colombia was destroyed by the United States substance abuse issues. Narco-trafficker is not only in Colombia, it's in Mexico. And I think when California borders are going to legalize marijuana, that will be very sad because I immigrate in this country because the demand of drugs. My life, the centuries of, my family, everything changed in Colombia and future generations because narco-traffickers. But of course, we are a very corrupt country. We have a lot of poverty. We have a lot of issues. But Colombian changed because United States influence, not only geographically, politically. And that's what I have to say.
All right. I thank you for your statement and have to go back to you, Daniel Restrepo, to respond to that.
I totally agree that the story of Colombia is an incredibly complex one. It is geographically a complex country and explains much of its history and the geographical challenges. It's the only place that the mountain chain that we know as the Rockies divides itself into three. That has created enormous challenges for the central state that I was talking about earlier. I think we need to remember also political violence in Colombia, as the previous caller had noted with the Bogotazo, well predates the drug problem in the United States. Certainly, the drug consumption in the United States has helped fuel the conflict and provide revenue to keep the conflict alive in Colombia, and has had an enormous detrimental effect on the Colombian society for now decades. But the problems of Colombia are beyond they're not just. They're certainly influenced by the international drug trade, but they're not just about the international drug trade. And that's why this agreement is not just about drugs. A fifth of it is about the drug problem and the challenges around it. But there's also fundamental changes that need to take place to deal with the inequalities that have plagued Colombia for too long. I think this is a real opportunity to continue down that path. Colombia's made progress, as I noted earlier, over the course of the last couple of decades, as many countries in the Americas have, of reducing inequality, bringing people out of poverty and abject poverty. But that work needs to continue. These agreements provide the implementation of these agreements will provide a window to do that, but it's by no means certain to succeed.
And you can add your voice here by calling us at our toll-free number in the time remaining, 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Robert writes, in a cynical world, this agreement should remind us that peace, even a seemingly intractable situation, is possible. But here's a tough question from Margarita, who asks, what are the risks or consequences for the reached agreements if the plebiscite goes for the no? Want to speculate on that, Cynthia Aronson?
Yes, I would. I think that there is the false hope by people who oppose the peace accords that if the no vote prevails, that there will somehow be an opportunity to reopen the negotiation with the FARC and improve them in ways that the opponents see as necessary. And I think that's really a delusion. I think that if the no vote prevails, that it will be back to war. And the FARC has not yet begun to demobilize. It has not yet begun to concentrate its forces. And it will go back to the conflict. And I would like to sort of touch on a couple of other points that have been brought out earlier. There are lots of opinion polls. They show different things in terms of the yes and the no vote. Pollsters have sort of come to an agreement that they're going to have a minimum number of people that they ask to participate in the polls before they publish results. But one of the things that's characteristic of polling in Colombia is that it's overwhelmingly urban. And the majority of the Colombian population lives in urban areas, but the majority of those who have been affected by the conflict are in rural or in small towns, rural areas or small towns. And those people, according to opinion polls that have been done there, show overwhelming support for the agreements and a much greater openness to questions of reconciliation and forgiveness with members of the FARC, and an eagerness, actually, for the FARC to participate in politics, to lay down their weapons, to stop kidnapping and harassing and extorting, but rather come out fair and square and participate in the political arena. So I think we need to keep that in mind and actually be humbled by the opinions of people who have suffered the brunt of this conflict over these many decades.
I'm going to go to more callers in just a moment here, but let me go first to David Tolbert. Assuming the plebiscite does pass, David Tolbert, and there is a truth commission set up, do we know anything at this point about how commissioners on that commission are going to be selected or the quality of who they're going to be?
Yeah, we do. And we have spent a good bit of time we have an office in Colombia and working on these issues. I went with Kofi Annan some time back and addressed these issues. We had done a study of various truth commissions coming out of peace processes. So there's I think the peace accord sets the framework, and we'll see truth commissioners of very high stature. I think where the controversy is probably more around the special jurisdiction for peace and the selection of judges, where we'll have the mixed chamber of international judges and national judges. So the international community is very deeply engaged in part of this. So that I feel pretty confident that the processes are in place. Of course, the results are. We'll have to see. I also should make one other footnote from my previous comments, particularly when we were talking about the special jurisdiction for peace. It's worth remembering that Colombia is a member of the International Criminal Court, and the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court obviously has jurisdiction over Colombia. So the special jurisdiction for peace, the issues that we're talking about in terms of accountability, thus far, she's indicated that she said some positive things about this, but we don't know what position she will take. But there is a kind of international safety check on this process, because the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction, and if the prosecutor feels like this is not going in the right direction, that justice is not being delivered in accordance with the Rome Statute, she has the ability to intervene. So I thought that was an important point that had not come out earlier in the conversation.
No, I'm glad you added that. And let me also add one other thing about the fact that there will be congressional representatives if the accord is approved from the FARC, a limited number of seats, to be sure, but through 2018, and they will have voting rights, but they will not presumably be able to speak about the peace accord. And let me go to more of your calls, and let's go to Alex next. Alex, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. So in 2012, Colombia passed the Labor Action Plan, a provision with the free trade agreement between U.S. and Colombia. It was supposed to protect labor and labor rights, and the effect of that has not been that labor has benefited from that law. So my question to the panel is, how will this new peace agreement help those most affected, meaning the 5 million people that have been displaced, lost their lands, lost their homes? How will those reparations take place, and what system will be in check to ensure that the Colombian justice system does provide these people back with their lands? I mean, some of these lands are now owned by U.S. corporations and elite families in Colombia.
Well, it does call, Cynthia Arntzen, the agreement, the accord does call for land reform, but how much along the lines of what we've heard this caller, Alex from Berkeley, outline?
Well, there's a tremendous problem of, you know, the lack of land registries going back for many, many years. In Colombia, there has been, even before the peace agreement and this very detailed accord on agrarian issues, a victims law that was approved by the Congress in 2011 after being presented by the Santos administration. And the number of beneficiaries of the victims law and land restitution law has been fairly minimal compared to the number of claimants. And it's just enormously difficult, long legal procedures. And the difficulty, obviously, is that people have been forced from their land but can't produce a title. So I see all of these things as taking years and decades to implement. And to be sure, the implementation is going to be very uneven, and there's no guarantee. And I think it's a mistake to look at the peace accord as this panacea for everything that has befallen Colombia and every problem that exists. I think there will be progress forward, positive momentum in a lot of areas, but to think that this is going to wave a magic wand and solve all of the human rights issues and the land issues is really expecting too much.
And let me thank Alex for his call. And again, Cynthia Arntzen is director of the Latin American Program with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. We're going to get another caller on from Hartford, Connecticut. Rhett joins us. Rhett, welcome.
Hello. Thanks. I'm glad I got on. Is there a lot of concern that although the leadership of the FARC has called for a peace now that the war is over, is there a lot of concern that some of the generals, so-called, or so to speak, under him that were commanding smaller groups will not want to have peace, will feel that it's more advantageous for them to continue fighting. Is there concern about that?
There is concern about that, I believe, Daniel Restrepo, isn't there?
There is. You've already had dissident groups, if you will, express that they are not on board, although I think they had a talking to and have publicly changed their view. But I think one of the challenges, one of the implementation challenges, and Cynthia talked about this earlier, will be precisely this. Will those, particularly those fronts of the FARC, which is kind of one of their subdivisions, that have been most deeply enmeshed in the drug trade, will they get out of the business? They may just put down the banner of the FARC and continue about their business after October 2nd, just as they have been for the last decade or more. So there is a challenge in terms of what percentage of the 5,000 to 7,000 men in arms that the FARC is today will actually lay down their arms and join the reintegration, the disarmament and reintegration process. I don't think anyone, including the FARC leadership and the Colombian leadership, know with any precision what that number is going to look like. And again, that's going to be one of the early challenges in the implementation.
There are indeed many challenges, monumental challenges. I want to get to one quick question here, though, because we're running out of time. And Daniel Restrepo, perhaps you can answer John's question. Can you comment on the Colombian government's use of U.S. herbicides on par with Agent Orange to deforest the rebel territories?
They have stopped using them.
Okay. We'll let it conclude there. And thank you, Daniel Restrepo. Daniel Restrepo is with the Center for American Progress. Thank you, Cynthia Arnson with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And thanks, David Tolbert with the International Center for Transitional Justice. And thanks to you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Jeremy Siegel, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Thank you for listening. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.